ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. The time now is 6 p.m.
Você já foi à Bahia, nega, não? Então vá.
Support comes from UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting Luciana Souza and Marcel Camargo on April 25th at the Nimoy. Grammy-nominated vocalist Luciana Souza and guitarist Marcel Camargo unite for New Moon, a spellbinding journey of voice, guitar, and strings. Blending Brazilian roots with bold new compositions, they create an intimate soul-stirring sound that invites you to listen closely and feel deeply. Further information and tickets at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
News on these stories and more coming up from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. This is the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Christina Onnestad. Talks of optimism that a peace deal can be reached between the U.S. and Iran after Israel and Lebanon agreed to a 10-day ceasefire today. Barrages of gunshots rang out across Beirut as residents fired into the air to celebrate an end to the violence. But Israel says its troops will remain in the southern part of Lebanon. The deal comes after the first direct diplomatic talks between Israel and Lebanon in decades this week in Washington, after more than a month of war between U.S. and Israel, and Iran and its allies in Lebanon, Hezbollah. The truce, if it holds, could boost attempts to extend a ceasefire between Iran and the United States after weeks of devastating war that's killed hundreds and thousands of people and upended global markets by disrupting the flow of oil. To that end, Pakistan's Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif arrived in Qatar as part of a regional visit aimed at U.S.-Iran peace talks, and Pakistan's army chief met with Iranian officials, including Iran's Joint Military Command, in Tehran today in a bid to extend the temporary ceasefire. Before the ceasefire was announced, Israel Katz, Israeli defense minister, issued this stark warning to Iran.
Iran is facing a historic crossroad. One path leads to renouncing the path of terror and nuclear weapons and choosing a future of stability and reconstruction as proposed by the U.S. The other path leads to an abyss from which the Iranian regime will not be able to escape. This is their moment of choice between a bridge to the future and an abyss of isolation and destruction. We have destroyed and struck all strategic targets and strategic capabilities of Iran. And if necessary, we will return to do so.
Meanwhile, Iran's allies, Yemen's Houthi rebels, say a truce between the U.S. and Iran would offer stability. Abdul Malik al-Houthi, Houthi leader, also warned American terms to end the war currently violate Iran's sovereignty.
It is known that the current two-week truce came about because the U.S. and Israel were forced into it after their major failures to achieve their goal of targeting the Islamic Republic of Iran. America's concept of negotiations is about imposing dictates and forcing others to submit to conditions that violate sovereignty of countries, confiscate the legitimate rights of people, target their independence, and present impossible demands that no independent country can accept.
He also said a ceasefire agreement would not hold as long as Israeli aggression against Lebanon continues, indicating the new 10-day ceasefire will be a major step towards ending the fighting all around. Iran is now reportedly willing to give up its enriched uranium as part of ceasefire talks. Russia has previously offered to take it. Christopher Martinez has more.
The sound of gunfire erupted over Beirut shortly after midnight Friday, but as gunfire goes, this was good gunfire, aimed not at people but at the sky, by residents celebrating the beginning of a truce agreement between Lebanon and Israel. At United Nations headquarters in New York, spokesperson Stéphane Dujarric welcomed the ceasefire.
We welcome steps that would end hostilities and suffering on both sides of the blue line. The United Nations, through our political and peacekeeping missions, remains ready to support these efforts and continues to urge the full implementation of Security Council Resolution 1701. And that full implementation is towards a permanent ceasefire and a long-term solution to the conflict.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the ceasefire was meant to advance peace efforts, but he says troops that have seized territory in Israel's invasion will not withdraw. Hezbollah said in a statement that any ceasefire must be comprehensive across all Lebanese territory and must not allow the Israeli enemy any freedom of movement. The 10-day ceasefire, which began at midnight local time, could help boost efforts to extend the ceasefire between Iran, the U.S., and Israel, which is scheduled to end next week on the 22nd. But President Donald Trump says he's not inclined to extend that ceasefire. Speaking at the White House West Lawn on the way to Las Vegas, he expressed optimism about the agreement.
They're all agreeing it's a very nice little package for about a week, and we're not going to have lots of bombs dropping, and we're going to see if we can make peace between Lebanon and Israel.
Of course, Israel and Lebanon have tried before to reach a peace deal. One reporter asked Trump, what's different this time?
Me. I'm the big difference. Me.
He calls the deal very exciting, and he seems to be chalking it up on the list of wars he claims to have ended.
And I think it could be number 10 for me.
Over at the Pentagon, the talk was less about ceasefires and more about U.S. military actions, including an escalation of the U.S. blockade of Iran, which began Monday. General Dan Kane is chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
The U.S. action is a blockade of Iran's ports and coastline, not a blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. Enforcement will occur inside Iran's territorial seas and in international waters.
He says more than 10,000 sailors, marines, and airmen are enforcing the blockade. He described it with a rather unusual sports metaphor.
It is like driving a sports car through a supermarket parking lot on a payday weekend with thousands of kids in that parking lot as you attempt to maneuver through there to get to that ship that would attempt to run that blockade.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth had his own somewhat bellicose message for Iran.
We are locked and loaded on your critical dual-use infrastructure, on your remaining power generation, and on your energy industry. We'd rather not have to do it, but we're ready to go at the command of our president and at the push of a button.
He also had some words for the press corps, dismissing negative coverage as the endless stream of garbage and calling it incredibly unpatriotic.
I sat there in church and I thought, our press are just like these Pharisees. Not all of you, not all of you, but the legacy Trump-hating press. Your politically motivated animus for President Trump nearly completely blinds you from the brilliance of our American warriors.
This is far from the first time Hegseth has used biblical rhetoric in describing and justifying the war. In a different way, Pope Leo XIV has also cited scripture on war.
Jesus told us, "Blessed are the peacemakers, but woe to those who manipulate religion in the very name of God for their own military, economic, or political gain, dragging that which is sacred into darkness and filth."
Speaking during a visit to Cameroon, he blasted what he called the handful of tyrants who are ravaging the world with war and exploitation.
"The masters of war pretend not to know that it takes only a moment to destroy. Yet often, a lifetime is often not enough to rebuild. They turn a blind eye to the fact that billions of dollars are spent on killing, on devastation. Yet the resources needed for healing, education, and restoration are nowhere to be found."
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
The son of the deposed Shah of Iran during the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Reza Pahlavi, is in Europe on a tour seeking support for regime change in Iran, with him as a transitional leader. Speaking to a gathering in Rome today, Pahlavi criticized the Trump administration for negotiating with Iran's current new leader.
"Mujtaba Khamenei, Khamenei's son, is no different than his father. It's a continuation of the regime. But there's something even worse. Because at least then you still had a theocracy to deal with. Now you have the IRGC practically becoming the state. You're talking about an IRGC that is now almost in control of governance. They make the final decision. And that's even more dangerous because on the one hand you're dealing with a terrorist organization as it has been designated that is now trying to negotiate with you. What do you think, what kind of a deal do you think they're going to try and reach? It's not for the interests of the Iranian nation. It is for their own survival. Giving them a chance to survive is spitting in the face of the Iranian people."
He said Iranians demonstrating around the world have been holding up his photo. His call for protests in January brought hundreds of thousands into the streets in the largest demonstration in years. Some say it was also aided by Israeli agents inside Iran. The Iranian government launched a fierce crackdown in January, killing thousands of people, detaining tens of thousands more. Pahlavi, who lives in Maryland, says he's ready to assume power and lead a democratic transition once the theocracy is overthrown. But that scenario has appeared increasingly unlikely, as Iran has weathered weeks of attacks and now a naval blockade with no sign of a popular uprising since the U.S. and Israel launched strikes against Iran. Pahlavi criticized U.S. negotiations with Iran's theocratic leadership.
"Why is it that right now that they're weak, right now that they're crumbling, all of a sudden you stop the momentum only because you think that you might obtain a different deal this time? Yes, I understand. Everybody's nervous about economic stability, the oil price rising. It has political consequences. Of course, we all realize that. But there will be a much higher price to pay if this situation continues, much worse than you can imagine."
Pahlavi's been in exile for nearly 50 years and says he's the best person to lead his country to a democratic future Iran, despite the fact his father, Iran Shah, was so widely hated. Millions took to the streets in 1979, forcing him from power. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says troops will remain in southern Lebanon, where fierce Israeli strikes have leveled entire villages. The Israeli military had killed 4 Lebanese rescue workers and wounded 6 others in 3 consecutive targeted strikes Wednesday, according to paramedic groups. It was just a day after the two countries held historic peace talks in Washington. The back-to-back attacks on the southern village of Maifadun near the bigger town of Nabatea hit the first group of medics responding to a distress call from wounded civilians, a second group trying to assist their wounded colleagues, and a third group rushing in to aid the first 2 teams that had been hit. The medics were Hezbollah-affiliated. The Israeli military did not respond to a request for comment by the Associated Press on the strikes, beyond saying it was looking into what happened. It has previously accused the Hezbollah group of using ambulances as cover for militant activities without giving evidence. Lebanon's health ministry condemned the attacks as a blatant violation of international law. Video from at least one of the paramedics shows the targeted bombing as rescue workers were loading injured colleagues into the paramedic van. The van hit with a strike. Since March 2nd, when fighting began, at least 91 Lebanese medical workers have been killed by Israeli strikes, Lebanon's ministry said, underscoring the intensity of the ongoing strikes and strain on Lebanon's health system. The overall death toll from the war in Lebanon, now more than 2,160. The strike comes days after Israel released footage of another drone strike killing a man who survived a strike on a vehicle, a double targeting. Video shows a survivor sitting against a tree, injured not far from a blown-out vehicle. The man covers his face as a drone approaches him and blows up, killing him. Israel claimed he's a Hezbollah member. Critics noted it's illegal to kill an injured enemy combatant. Strikes continued today. UN Staffan de Jarre condemned attacks on medical facilities and personnel before the ceasefire was announced.
It's happening in a hospital, a key trauma facility in southern Lebanon, so its emergency department and other critical facilities damaged. But it remains operational. Since the escalation, attacks on healthcare have resulted in 88 deaths and more than 200 injuries among healthcare workers. These incidents constitute a serious violation of international humanitarian law and severely, obviously, undermines people's access to healthcare at a time where they need it most.
According to the United Nations, one-fifth of Lebanon's population is now displaced, with needs growing daily. Over 1 million people have been displaced across Lebanon. Israeli strikes have killed more than 2,100 and caused 7,000 injuries, according to Lebanon's Ministry of Health. It also says refugees are among the casualties, with 48 fatalities, 116 injuries. More than 140,000 individuals are sheltering in some 600 government collective shelters, nearly at full capacity. The Republican-controlled House of Representatives today rejected a war powers resolution that would have required President Donald Trump obtain congressional authorization to continue the war with Iran. The vote comes a day after the Republican-controlled Senate rejected a similar bill. KPFA's Max Pringle reports.
Democrats voiced concern that the United States is becoming further entrenched in another lengthy conflict in the Middle East. New York Democrat Gregory Meeks is ranking member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He authored the resolution.
Now, let me just say that it's our job to determine when our troops should go across. And that's what this is about. We all support our troops. But it's our determination in Congress when we should treat them there, not a king.
The 213-214 vote came one day after the Senate rejected a similar resolution, mostly along party lines. The U.S. and Israel struck Iran at the end of February, and a fragile ceasefire is now in place for a second week. Republican Brian Mast said the Democrats are making national security a political issue.
When Joe Biden was responding to merchant marine vessels being attacked, it was okay. No war power needed. Went on for about a year. President Trump responds, war power, war power, war power, war power.
The House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries from New York said President Trump went to war with no plan and no clear war objectives, and Americans are paying a high price.
We're standing on the side of the American people, standing on the side of the Constitution, standing on the side of the principle that if we're going to spend billions and billions of taxpayer dollars, it should actually be spent to make life more affordable for the American people, not plunge us into a reckless and costly war of choice that is actually making life more expensive for the American people in provable and tangible ways.
Under the War Powers Act of 1973, Congress must declare war or authorize use of force within 60 days. The deadline in this conflict is at the end of April. The law provides for a potential 30-day extension, but lawmakers have made clear that they want the Republican administration to soon lay out a plan for the war's conclusion. Democrats say they plan to keep raising the issue. For KPFA News, I'm Max Pringle.
The Senate also rejected two bills to block arms shipments to Israel Wednesday after blocking a war powers resolution in the chamber.
Israel did not have the right to bomb over 90% of the hospitals in Gaza. Hospitals.
Independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders introduced the pair of resolutions. He's been a long critic of Israel's right-wing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He spoke on the Senate floor ahead of the vote and said Israel has a right to defend itself.
Israel did not have the right to bomb over 90% of the hospitals in Gaza, hospitals, and kill 1,700 healthcare workers. And Mr. President, Israel did not have the right to impose a blockade which prevented food, water, and medicine from entering Gaza, resulting in thousands of Palestinians being diagnosed with malnutrition and hundreds actually starving to death.
Another resolution would have blocked the sale of bulldozers to Israel, which Israel's used to destroy Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank. Similar resolutions forced by Sanders in previous years, 2024 and 2025, were also rejected, but the number of Democrats voting for his resolutions Wednesday has more than doubled amid Israel's campaigns in Gaza, Iran, and Lebanon, and a pressure campaign within the Democratic National Committee. Arizona Senator Democrat Mark Kelly voiced his support of the two resolutions after opposing some of Sanders' previous efforts. In a speech just before the vote, Kelly said the reckless decisions being made by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and President Donald Trump led him to his decision, which he said he did not take lightly.
I oppose this war in Iran and the reckless decisions being made by Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump. Under Prime Minister Netanyahu's government, we've seen an expanded war in Lebanon that is putting innocent Lebanese civilians at risk, and ongoing violence against Palestinians and their homes being demolished in the West Bank. All of this has undermined the path forward for peace. That matters when we are making decisions about sending these weapons.
Among the Democrats voting against the resolutions were Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, even after 100 protesters were arrested during a demonstration Monday, calling on the two to vote in favor of Sanders' measures. Republicans say the vote could hurt U.S. efforts on the Iran war. Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair Jim Risch of Idaho said the resolutions would embolden Iran and send the message the U.S. is prepared to leave our ally Israel vulnerable. After the vote, Sanders said it's clear Democrats are beginning to listen to the average American, who he said is sick and tired of spending billions of dollars to support Netanyahu's horrific wars when people in this country can't afford housing or health care, Bernie Sanders said. Trump family business deals have set precedents for other presidents. While the war economy is impacting prices and hitting pocketbooks of people around the world, for some industries, including those connected to the Trump family, business is booming. An analysis by the UK's Guardian publication finds during the first month of the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran, the world's top 100 oil and gas companies raked in more than $30 million in profits each hour. Companies like ExxonMobil and Saudi Aramco, as the Saudi government said it was closing some production due to strikes on its facilities, saw some of the highest windfall profits. The analysis found oil and gas companies could make $234 billion by the end of the year if oil prices continue to average $100 a barrel. Meanwhile, a drone maker backed by President Donald Trump's two oldest sons, who are now executives of the company, is trying to win contracts with Gulf countries hosting U.S. military bases that are targets of Iran. Power Us is holding demonstrations in several Gulf countries of how its defensive drone interceptors could help them ward off the attacks, according to co-founder Brett Velakovich. Power Us recently struck a deal that will bring on the Trump brothers, Eric and Don Jr., as stakeholders in the military contractor. This latest Trump venture also has their sights on $1.1 billion in U.S. military contracts at the Pentagon to build up a U.S. manufacturing base for armed drones to fill a hole left when the Trump administration banned such imports from China. Founded by U.S. Army Special Operations veterans about a year ago, Power Us makes drones for commercial uses, from spreading fertilizer to putting out forest fires. But it's bulking up fast to supply drones for military use. Power Us denied there's any conflicts when the Trump brothers' stake was first announced. Velasevich emphasized its determination to help the U.S. catch up with Chinese and Russian drone makers and beat them. Asked about potential Power Us conflicts of interest, Eric Trump sent the Associated Press a statement saying, "I am incredibly proud to invest in companies I believe in. Drones are clearly the wave of the future." The president's oldest sons have expanded their business interests beyond hotels and golf courses since Donald Trump took office again. The companies they've invested in or been named advisors for, with equity stakes, run the gamut from cryptocurrency ventures to prediction markets to federal contractors making rocket parts and rare earth magnets. Trump next week will host the top investors in his meme coin cryptocurrency at Mar-a-Lago in Florida next week, in the midst of wartime negotiations. The group Crew, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, wrote on social media of President Donald Trump's meeting with top investors of his meme coin next week, quote, "Not only is this blatantly corrupt, it's a national security threat," unquote. The Trump family has increased its business dealings under Donald Trump's second stint in the White House. Some warn it's setting a bad precedent for the White House overall and future presidencies. Whereas the Trump Organization didn't officially do a single deal overseas during Trump's first term in the White House, it did, or at least closed, eight business deals in the last year, more than double the money in 4 months selling Trump meme coins than it did in 4 years running a massive hotel in Washington, D.C., in which international politicians and global leaders were quick to book stays in what some called the violation of the Emoluments Clause, which bars taking money and gifts from foreigners. It's a perversion of past presidents' attempts at business neutrality. Harry Truman refused to lend his name to any business, even in retirement. Richard Nixon so feared a brother might profit off their ties, he had his phone tapped. And George W. Bush dumped his individual stock holdings before taking office. President Trump is taking a different approach, like that of governments in authoritarian and one-party states that rarely take a hands-off approach when business belongs to a sitting president. The Trump family real estate business is undergoing the fastest overseas expansion since its founding nearly a century ago, each deal potentially shaping everything from tariffs to military aid. In Qatar, a Trump golf club and villa project is being developed in part by a company owned by the Qatari government. In Vietnam, where the New York Times reported the government pushed farmers off their land to make a way for a Trump resort. The country's deputy prime minister signed off on the deal at a ceremony. And in Saudi Arabia, a planned Trump Plaza resort on the Red Sea is being built by a Saudi developer close to the ruling family. Whether the deals played any role in changing U.S. policies in ways these countries sought is nearly impossible to know. But the countries did get what they wanted: access to advanced technology for Qatar, tariff relief for Vietnam, and fighter jets for Saudi Arabia. In the Trump administration, its organization, the Trump Family Business, the Trump Organization, also got something too: tens of millions of dollars in business fees for those transactions. You are listening to the Pacifica Evening News from KPFA 94.1 FM, 89.3 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, and KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles.
Support for KPFK comes from a screening of the documentary Steal This Story on Friday, April 17, 2026, as a fundraiser for KPFK. The event takes place at the Lemley Royal in West Los Angeles with a screening at 1:10 p.m. and 7:10 p.m. Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman will be in attendance for a Q&A session alongside filmmakers Carl Diehl and Tia Lesson. Information and full event details are available at kpfk.org.
This is KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. 98.7 FM, Santa Barbara. Worldwide at kpfk.org. This is KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. 98.7 FM, Santa Barbara. Worldwide at kpfk.org.
Again, a big thank you to those who gave yesterday. We raised $22,700 out of the goal of raising $30,000 to celebrate Pacifica Radio 77 years on the air. We still have about $7,200 left to raise. If you are feeling generous and want to help celebrate Pacifica Radio and free speech media, independent media, you can give online at 1-800-439-5732. If you're listening online, just click on the Donate Here button. We still have tickets available for the KPFA birthday gift celebration this Saturday at the Alameda Theater and Cineplex starting at 2 o'clock. It's the screening of KPFA On the Air documentary and 77th birthday party. The event with Amy Goodman the following day on Sunday, Steal This Story, is now fully sold out. But we do still have tickets for the Saturday screening again of KPFA On the Air. That's for a pledge of $77 for Pacifica Radio's 77th birthday. You can get two tickets for a donation of $150. And that, again, is a screening of KPFA On the Air. It's a documentary. Starts at 2 p.m. at the Alameda Theater and Cineplex, with a birthday celebration at the California Historical Radio Society to follow. That will also have a panel where I'll be speaking about something about the lovely Pacifica Radio. A new whistleblower who worked for the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, the U.S.-backed group that assisted in aid distribution in Gaza, says he saw Israeli soldiers use deadly force on Palestinians seeking aid, including on a 12-year-old boy. David McIntosh, a former contractor with Safe Reach Solutions, hired to organize logistics for the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, spoke to the Middle East Eye, which released a video on social media.
And he's still laughing around, asking to do, he's 12 years old. A few moments later, the IDF sniper shoots him in his shoulder, falls to the ground. He lies there for a moment. He gets up, he stumbled across the bridge, falls down, and he's lying there 30 minutes before anybody I see it in the report comes to collect him. But taking a round of that velocity to the shoulder and being unconscious for 30 minutes, you're going to be deceased. You are going to be dead.
McIntosh says, like the 12-year-old boy, other Palestinian aid seekers pose no threat when Israeli forces used deadly force. Some 2,000 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces during the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation's aid operation. It's now building out a new aid distribution system in Gaza. Israeli attacks in Gaza still continue despite a ceasefire. Funerals were held in Gaza City today for two brothers who were killed by a drone strike. They were killed near their home in Beit Lahia, about 300 feet away from the yellow line, which was drawn in the ceasefire agreement and divides the Israeli-held majority of Gaza from the rest of the territory. Israel's military didn't respond to a request for comment but from the Associated Press, but family said they were preparing for a wedding the day they were bombed. Earlier this week, Israeli strikes also killed a 3-year-old Palestinian boy among five killed in northern Gaza City. The strike hit a police vehicle, killing four people, including a 3-year-old who was standing nearby. Another in the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza killed a 15-year-old. Saima al-Mahali is a grandmother of the child who was killed.
Today there's a real crisis the city is going through as a result of bug infestations and rodents. There is a fertile environment for them. There are more than 25 million tons of rubble in Gaza City, out of 70 million tons of rubble in the Gaza Strip.
We have been waiting for de-escalation. We have been waiting for 3 years. Every day we say today, we are in desperate need for each minute. We want de-escalation. We want peace. We want goodness. This is what we want. We are suffering. I swear, we are exhausted. What was this little kid's fault? He was just walking down the street.
The Gaza Strip has seen near daily deadly Israeli fire and strikes since a ceasefire was supposedly reached in October. More than 750 Palestinians have been killed since then, according to Gaza's health ministry. Meanwhile, tent cities of displaced residents are grappling with rat and bug infestations due to the widespread destruction of infrastructure, particularly sewage. Residents say they've been bitten by rodents. Hosni Mohana is Gaza's municipality spokesperson.
Today there's a real crisis the city is going through as a result of bug infestations and rodents. There is a fertile environment for them. There are more than 25 million tons of rubble in Gaza City, out of 70 million tons of rubble in the Gaza Strip. We are also talking about massive destruction of the infrastructure, especially the sewage system. These are suitable environments for rodents.
The Pentagon bombed another suspected drug boat in the Eastern Pacific Ocean Wednesday, killing three people it called narco-terrorists without providing proof. This comes a day after the military bombed another boat accused of carrying drugs in the Eastern Pacific, killing four people Tuesday. Another strike Monday killed two people, and the military said it attacked two boats Saturday. Wednesday's strike brings the death toll to 178 since the U.S. began bombing boats accused of trafficking drugs last September in the Pacific and Caribbean oceans. As we've reported, the DEA's own report from 2025 finds most drugs, including fentanyl, not coming through the Caribbean or Pacific oceans. Fentanyl, mainly produced in Mexico from products imported from China. The U.S. Coast Guard suspended the search of one of the survivors from an attack over the weekend. President Trump has justified those attacks as necessary to combat drug flow into the U.S. The critics question the legality and effectiveness. At least 53 vessels have been targeted. The United Nations has warned against extrajudicial killings. There's a holdup on Capitol Hill in advancing the renewal of a program that lets U.S. spy agencies pore over foreigners' calls texts, and emails. House Republican leaders hope to advance the legislation Wednesday, but an initial procedural step has been delayed. The provision of the FISA, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, is set to expire Monday. Max Pringle reports.
Iowa Republican Senator Chuck Grassley took to the Senate floor today to argue that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, gives law enforcement and the intelligence services a valuable tool to keep the public safe.
Section 702 is an essential national security tool. That law is responsible for over 60% of the intelligence in the president's daily brief. Section 702 enables our intelligence and law enforcement community to thwart attacks before they occur.
Critics say FISA's Section 702 gives the government far too much leeway to monitor Americans' communications, and because it doesn't require a warrant, could be a violation of the Fourth Amendment's protections against unlawful searches and seizures. Illinois Democrat Dick Durbin argued against it on the Senate floor.
This authority is also used for warrantless spying on innocent Americans. Americans' private email, phone calls, and text messages with friends, family, colleagues, business, and any number of other contacts around the world are swept up under Section 702. The government then searches these private communications, protected by the Fourth Amendment, I might add, without a warrant or other court order.
The Trump administration has mounted a pressure campaign that included a trip to the White House and direct involvement from CIA Director John Ratcliffe. Ohio Republican Congressman Jim Jordan chairs the House Judiciary Committee. He told the House Rules Committee that Section 702's reauthorization is not permanent and comes at a crucial time for the country.
We're talking months, not years. We're not talking a 10-year reauthorization. We're not talking a 5-year reauthorization. We're talking 18 months after 56 reforms that have definitely worked while we're facing the threats that we face and while we're involved in the military conflicts that we're involved with. Again, I would urge a yes vote.
However, Maryland Democrat Jamie Raskin told the same committee that he doesn't trust the Trump administration to run the program above board.
The clean extension is a dirty deal. The bill before us today leaves the Trump administration in charge of policing its own abuses of this sweeping authority. That is going to be unacceptable to the American people, who understand how our privacy rights and civil liberties are being trampled every day. FISA needs independent guardrails, and my colleagues on the Intelligence Committee acknowledge as much.
Some lawmakers have proposed changes to Section 702 to add extra protections for Americans. Jim Himes, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, announced a proposal Tuesday that would require the Justice Department to seek a court order before the FBI could assess search results involving Americans' communications. KPFA News, I'm Max Pringle.
The man accused of setting a warehouse on fire in Ontario, California, 29-year-old Shamel Abdulkarim, pled not guilty in court this week to arson and other charges. He was employed by a subcontractor for Kimberly Clark Paper Products Company and reportedly filmed himself setting the products on fire, saying all you had to do was pay us enough to live.
All you had to do was pay us enough to live. All you had to do was pay us enough to live. All you had to do was pay us enough to live. There goes your inventory.
The 1.2 million square foot warehouse incinerated inside to the ground. Abdulkarim now faces state charges and federal charges that could send him to prison for decades, up to life. He was charged with arson of a building used in interstate and foreign commerce. Bill Asaley, first assistant U.S. attorney, said, and is scheduled for a court hearing Friday on state charges. While it spread on social media, other warehouse fires have followed. There's no proof the fires were sparked over wages on those warehouse fires or working conditions. The Los Angeles Unified School District reached a tentative deal Monday with the union representing support workers like bus drivers, cafeteria staffers, and janitors, avoiding a possible strike at the nation's second largest school district. The district serves nearly 400,000 students in Southern California. Local 99 of the service employees international union announced early it won a tentative agreement with major gains, including raises and more hours. The district announced an agreement in principle had been reached, allowing schools to be open. Teachers, principals, and staff have been prepared to walk out for a strike in solidarity. The unions reached tentative agreements with the district over the weekend. The Department of Justice and Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department and District Attorney's Office are investigating sexual abuse allegations against former Congressman Democrat Eric Swalwell, who represented Alameda and Contra Costa counties at the nation's capital. They joined Manhattan in investigating allegations, and all five women have accused the one-time prosecutor turned Congressman of sexual assault or misconduct, spanning from rape to sending inappropriate photos. Swalwell continues to deny the allegations against him, though his resignation letter to Congress notes lapses on judgment. A former aide is accusing Swalwell of rape in a Manhattan hotel room in 2024 while she was intoxicated. A woman in Los Angeles accusing Swalwell of rape earlier this week. Three other women accused Swalwell of sending explicit messages or nude photos. Yesterday, U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, Janine Pirro, posted a video on social media announcing a new tip line for information about Swalwell's alleged conduct from other potential victims. Meanwhile, Republicans have introduced a bill called the Swalwell Act, which would prohibit the use of taxpayer funds for settlements of workplace misconduct claims involving members of Congress or their senior staff, and mandate referral of criminal allegations to the Justice Department should claims of misconduct arise. Arizona Congressman Paul Gosar is a sponsor of the Swalwell Act. Gosar was censured in 2021 for posting an anime video of himself as a ninja killing progressive Democrat Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez with a sword. Since 2018, reforms began requiring the Office of Congressional Workplace Rights to report awards and settlements related to formal misconduct complaints in Congress. It shows eight payments made by House members' offices, totaling more than $400,000. Those payments cover all sorts of violations of workplace rights, not just sexual harassment. Violations could have been committed by other congressional staff in the same office. Meanwhile, Governor Gavin Newsom has issued a proclamation setting a special election to fill the congressional seat for Swalwell in the 14th District. That date, April 18th of 2026. Swalwell's resignation leaves no one representing the 14th District, including parts of Alameda and Contra Costa counties. Nine candidates are vying for Swalwell's seat in the November race, which he could not run for since he was running for governor. The nine candidates will be on the midterm June 2nd primary ballot. The winners from that election will advance to the November 3rd midterm ballot. Newsom also set up a special June 16th primary to elect someone to fill the remainder of Swalwell's seat to the end of his term, January of 2027. If no candidate emerges with a majority vote on June 16th, the top two vote-getters will advance to a special runoff for August 18th. That winner will serve Swalwell's term to the end of the year. The union representing more than 42,000 University of California service and patient care technical workers announced an open-ended strike next month over wages and benefits. AFSCME Local 3299 Executive Vice President Catherine Limbarger spoke with KPFA News from a rally at UCSF Mission Bay Medical Center in San Francisco yesterday, Wednesday.
Like Californians everywhere, UC workers face an affordability crisis. You know, the 42,000 people we represent are also some of the lowest paid workers at the University of California system. We're majority women, people of color. You know, the work that we do is, you know, we empty bedpans for, you know, if you're in the hospital, we answer the call button if you're in a hospital bed. We clean dorm rooms and hospital rooms. We feed patients and students. We keep every university facility safe and clean and beautiful. We're finding the cost of housing to be unsustainable. We've got some people who sleep in their cars or homeless shelters, folks who commute hours each way to and from work. And so our demands are really that, you know, UC pay us wages that we can live on.
The University of California said on its website it was disappointed to hear the strike and acknowledged the housing crisis impacting its workforce. It also said it's offering a total wage growth of 32% increase over 5 years ending in 2029. A $1,000 bonus for each career AFSCME represented employee adjusted for part and full-time status. And on health care, the UC said more than 16,000 AFSCME UC employees pay less than $100. About half, more than 8,000, pay zero. Libarger says the UC changed its cap rate without bargaining over that, a violation of its contract. And while it sounds like a lot, 30% over 5 years isn't that much when you account for inflation.
It's actually not 32% for everybody. If you're at the top of your pay range, you don't get all of that. But more than that, 32% of a low wage, if it still leaves you low wage and unable to pay your rent, it is not enough. And I think that's the point I want to make here. Executives have seen their pay double over the last 10 years. So A, if they can do that for executives, and frankly, doubling a UC's executive salary costs a lot more in actual dollars than it does to raise the pay of a custodian. You know, UC can certainly do better by their frontline workers.
She says they also want the UC to offer a down payment housing assistance to its lowest paid workers, similar to what it does for its highest paid executives. City leaders in Oakland are facing a fierce debate over how to manage a growing number of encampments lining city streets. The Housing and Dignity Project gathered at City Hall this week to challenge a proposed encampment abatement policy, which they describe as inhumane, shift towards enforcement over support. The Oakland City Council reportedly passed that. The proposal comes as the city grapples with a crisis that sees Oakland housing more than half of Alameda County's entire homeless population, despite making up only 22% of the county's residents. KPFA's health and well-being reporter Annetta Felix reports.
After hours of heated debate and public comments, Oakland City Council members voted to adopt a revised encampment abatement policy, a controversial plan to address homelessness in Oakland. The policy, also known as EAP, was introduced by Councilmember Ken Houston, who says that the current living conditions of unhoused people are undignified.
Do you see that? Looks like a pile of trash, does it? But it's not. Someone is living in this. Is that humane or is that inhumane? It's inhumane for anyone to live like this. This encampment abatement policy is not going to fix everything. It's not. But the encampment managed policy did not work. It worked for that time. It's not working right now. It's inhumane for anyone to think that it's okay to let individuals live out in the street like that. That's inhumane.
The policy aims to align Oakland with state standards to secure more HAP funding, a multi-billion-dollar California state grant to address homelessness. California currently holds 30% of America's homelessness population. Patricia Brooks, presenting the proposal, warned that without stricter enforcement, Oakland could become a destination for those displaced from other cities.
This policy restores shared spaces and improves the quality of life. We want to connect people to services. Abatements are not just removals. They are opportunities for outreach. We connect people to shelter, services, and long-term housing pathways. The goal is stability, not displacement.
But public comments were sharply divided. Local residents and business owners say they worry over the state of public parks and sidewalks and urge the council to take action.
For too long, Oakland has been treated like a dumping ground for the entire state's homeless population. As a taxpaying citizen, we're forced to deal with a daily reality of needles, tents, garbage, and feces on our sidewalks. This level of degradation has somehow become business as usual in our city, while other regions simply push their problems onto our streets. What is truly crazy is that it's been normalized and that we even have to be here to have this discussion.
I have been an Oakland resident since 1993, and within the span of a few short years have become a dumping ground for the rest of the Bay Area. The status quo is not working. The perfect solution is not out there at this time. But what we need to do, and that I urge the council to vote on, we need a starting point. We need to put a line in the sand, and we need to say, this is acceptable, this is not acceptable.
This policy is a fair balance between the old encampment management policy and the encampment abatement policy. Thank you, Councilmember Houston.
But the voices against the EAP were overwhelming.
The main flaw of this piece of legislation is that there's no alternative presented. It's all about how do you move people out from where they are. And there's no plan to create 5,000 shelter beds that are going to be needed to do that. You've got more than 5,000 people on the streets. Where are you going to move them to?
My name is Ifa Layo, a homefulness resident in Wood Street Commons in the building. First and foremost, stop the sweeps. Vehicle residency is a symptom of system failure, not preference. Involuntary displacement is medically dangerous. The enforcement process is a costly revolving door that solves nothing.
The EAP as it stands will cause immense harm to unhoused Oaklanders and is in direct opposition to the mayor's plan because it fails to answer the most basic question. Where can unhoused people go?
The people you're talking about are human beings. Help them without hurting them. And for God's sakes, don't be afraid of them.
Criminalizing people for living on the street does not create housing. It does not create safety. It does not address the root causes that brought people there in the first place. It simply removes people, disrupts what little stability they have, and makes it harder for them to access services, care, and support. We all want safer, healthier communities, but real safety comes from investment, not from punishment. It comes from access to housing, mental health care, substance use treatment, and basic services.
New proposal puts the city at risk of increased costly litigation, meaning it may never be implemented while the city spends thousands defending the policy in court.
An internal audit of the city of Oakland shows that the city spends more than $1,500 an hour on sweeps and towing vehicles. Advocates say this costly spending should be redirected to permanent housing solutions. Nita B., founder of nonprofit The Village in Oakland.
The EAP wants to literally disappear the unhoused, a move in direct opposition to the mayor and the new Office of Homeless Solution that states in their new strategic plan that sweeps are costly, ineffective, solve nothing, and caused irreparable harm, including increased mortality rates. Decades of research and experience show that police enforcement-based homelessness policies are an exorbitant waste of money that only make the problem worse and increase death rates amongst the unhoused.
Council members Zach Unger and others introduced amendments to ensure the policy did not criminalize homeless people or require their vehicles towed without proper processes. The council ultimately voted 5-1 to adopt a resolution to officially repeal the 2020 management guidelines. This new 2025 EAP basically rules that a vehicle is not an encampment. The distinction means that Oakland would have to site and tow inhabited RVs and cars.
The benefits of donating your used vehicle to KPFK include funding new and existing programming, as well as increasing community awareness. You also benefit by being able to reduce your taxable income. There's no need to deal with the hassles of selling it, and you support public radio in the process. To donate your vehicle, please call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO.
To engage in any activity
that shall contribute
to a lasting understanding
between nations and between the individuals of all nations,
races, creeds, and colors.
To gather and disseminate information
on the causes of conflict
between any and all of such groups,
and through any and all means
compatible with the purposes of this corporation,
to promote the study of political and economic problems
and of the causes of religious, philosophical,
and racial antagonisms.
That is our mission. Yeah.